used to try and avoid writing about depression when I had it. I thought it was it was improper to write about these things, but use poetry merely as therapy. But you get sick enough, you'll use it. You'll use anything. And this is the poem that more or less broke its back. It's called Burning Want. From just on puberty, I lived in funeral. Mother dead of miscarriage, father trying to be dead. We'd boil sweat brown cloth. Cows repossessed the garden. Lovemaking brought death was the unuttered principle. I met a tall adopted girl, some kids thought aloof, but she was intelligent. Her poise of white blonde hair proved her no kin to the squat tan couple who loved her. Only now do I realise she was my first love. But all my names were fat names at my new town school. Between classes, kids did erocide, destruction of sexual morale. Mass refusal of unasked love, that works. Boys cheered as 17-year-old girls came on to me, then ran back whinnying ridicule. The slender girl came up on holidays from the city to my cousin's farm. She was friendly and sane. Whispers giggled round us. A letter was written, as from me, and she was there in mid-term instantly. But I called people the humans, not knowing it was rage. I learned things sidelong, taking my rifle for walks, recited every scene of From Here to Eternity, burned paddocks and soldiered back each Monday to that dawning teenage. She I admired and almost relaxed from placating, was gnawed by knowing what she came from, not who. Showing off was my one social skill, oddly never with her, but I dissembled feelings till mine were unknown to me too. And I couldn't add my want to her shortfall of wantedness. I had 40 more years with one dear remission of a white paralysis. She's attracted, it's not real, nothing is enough. She's mistaken, she'll die, go now, she'll tell, any minute she'll laugh. Whether other hands reached out to Marion or didn't, at 19 in her training ward she had a fatal accident, alone at night, they said, with a lethal injection, and was spared from seeing what my school did to the world. Of course, that wasn't the whole story, but it was a bit of it. I felt a lot better after it, put it that way. Television is a considerable enemy of poetry. The two don't mix very well. The attention span of television is very short. And so I thought I'd write a television poem or series of, and they're called Sound Bites. Attended by thousands, the sun is opening. It's a body prayer, a shower. You're in touch all over, renewing, enfolded in a wing. My sorrow, only 65,000 welcomes left in Scott's Gaeldom now. Poor cultures can afford poetry. Wealthy cultures can't. Sex is the ever-appeased class system that defeats utopias. But I bask in the pink that you're in, repeat, I bask in the pink that you're in. One day, as two continents are dividing, the whole length of a river turns salt. What's sketched at light speed, thunder must track bumbling for miles. If love shows you its terrible face before its beautiful face, you'll be accursed. People watching with their mouths an increasing sky birth of meteors. X chromosomes of history, apologise to your... Y chromosomes of history, apologise to your exes. Somebody mentioned about poems, lazy poems that don't rhyme. So I thought I'd better read a rhyming one at this stage. I do rhyme about 20% of the time, I guess. This one's called Downhill on Borrowed Skis. White mongrel, I hate snow. Wadded, numbing moose. Grog face in a fur noose. The odd miraculous view through glass or killing you. The only time I skied, I followed no skilled lead, but on parallel lent boards fell straight down a hill. Fell standing up by clenched will, very fast on toe-point swords, over log shapes and schist, outcrips, crops, it was no pissed, nor had I had any drinks. Wishing my ankle steel links, winging at hammer and shazam, no stocks in afternoon murk, every cloud gap royally flash, like heading into a car crash. Aye, the pain, the paperwork. My hands, I didn't flail them though, neither left nor right, neither shush nor slay them. My splitting splay twin sled, pumping, straining to spread to a biplane wreck of snapped ligaments, all hell played with locked joints. But still I skidded down erect in my long spill of grist, blinded hawk on a wrist, entirely unschooled, unchecked, the worst going on, not and not happening, no sprawl, no bone shot, till I stood on the flat, being unlatched and exclaimed at. This is a portrait of an interesting individual, our son Alexander, who's autistic. And it's like a television portrait in that it's made out of lines that gradually add up to a picture, a composite sort of thing. I started writing it as a list and realised I was writing a curious kind of long line poem. So I went ahead and did it. He was 15 at the time, he's 27 now, so some things have changed and moved on. But the poem is called It Allows a Portrait in Line Scan at 15. He retains a slight Margin accent from the years of single phrases. He no longer hugs to disarm, it is gradually allowing him affection. It does not allow proportion. Distress is absolute, shrieking and runs him at frantic speed through crashing doors. He likes cyborgs, their taciturn power with his intonation. It still runs him around the house alone in the dark, cooing and laughing. He can read about soils, populations and New Zealand. On neutral topics, he's illiterate. Arnie Schwarzenegger is an actor. He isn't a cyborg, really, is he, Dad? He lives on 40 acres with animals and trees and used to draw it continually. He knows the map of Earth's fertile soils and can draw it freehand. He can only lie in a panicked shout, "Sorry, sorry, I didn't do it," warding off conflict with others and himself. When he ran away constantly, it was to the greengrocers to worship stacked fruit. His favourite country was the Ukraine. It is nearly all deep, fertile soil. Giggling, he climbed all over the dim Freudian psychiatrist who told us how autism resulted from refrigerator parents. When asked to smile, he photographs a rictus smile on his face. It longed for bad, all-naturalistic films. They were adult movies. If they, that is he, are bad, the police will put them in hospital. He sometimes drew the farm amid Chinese or Balinese rice terraces. When a runaway, he made uproar in the police station, playing at three times adult speed. Only animated films were proper. Who Framed Roger Rabbit, then authorised the rest? Phrases spoken to him, he would take as teaching and repeat. When he worshipped fruit, he screamed as if poisoned when it was fed to him. A one-word first conversation. Blaine. Yes, Blaine, that's right, baby. Blaine. He has forgotten nothing and remembers the precise quality of experiences. It requires rulings. Is stealing very playing up as bad as murder? He counts at a glance, not looking, and he has never been lost. When he ate only nuts and dried fruit, words were for dire emergencies. He knows all the breeds of fowls and the counties of Ireland. He'd begun to talk, then returned to babble, then silence. It withdrew speech for years. When he took your hand, it was to work it as a multi-purpose tool. He is anger's mirror and magnifies any near him, raging it down. It still won't allow him fresh fruit or orange juice with bits in it. He swam in the midwinter dam at night. It had no rules about cold. He was terrified of thunder and finally cried as if in explanation, "It angry!" He lives in objectivity. I was sure Bell's palsy would leave my face only when he said it had begun to. Don't say word when he was 8 forbade the word autistic in his presence. Bantering questions about girlfriends caused a terrified look and blocked the ears. He sometimes scented the farm in a furrowed American Midwest. Eye contact, Mum, means he truly wants attention. It dislikes eye contact. He is equitable and kind and only ever a little jealous. It was a relief when that little arrived. He surfs, bowls, walks for miles. For many years he hasn't trailed his left arm while running. I gotta get smart, looking terrified into the years. I gotta get smart. Here's one of those scary poems. Rock music. Sex is a Nazi. The students all knew this at your school. To it, everyone's subhuman for parts of their lives. Some are all their lives. You'll be one of those if these things worry you. The beautiful Nazis, why are they so cruel? Why to castrate the aberrant, the original, the wounded, who might change our species and make obsolete the true race, which is those who never leave school? For the truth we are silent. For the flattering dream in mass farting reassurance we spasm and scream. But what is a Nazi but sex pitch for crowds? It's the Calvin SS. You are what you've got. And you'll wrinkle and fawn and work after your shot, though tears pour in secret from the hot indoor clouds. And this is a bush poem. There was a time when a lot of land in Australia was being foreclosed on by banks. I guess there was always a time when that was happening. It's called The Rollover. Some of us primary producers, us farmers and authors, are going around to watch them evict a banker. It'll be sad. I hate it when the toddlers and wives are out beside the fence crying and the big kids wear that thousand-yard stare common in all refugees. Seeing home desecrated as you lose it can do that to you. There's the ute piled high with clothes and old debentures. There's the faithful VDU shot dead, still on its lead. This fellow's dad and granddad were bankers before him. They sweated through the old hard inspections, had years of brimming foreclosure, but here it all ends. He'd lent three quarters and only asked for a short extension, 6 months. But you have to line the drawer somewhere. You have to be kind to be cruel. It's Sydney or the cash these times. Who buys the legend of the bank anymore? The laconic teller, the salt of the earth branch accountant. It's all an owned boy's story. Now they reckon he's grabbed a gun and an old coin sieve and holed up in the vault screaming about his years of work, his identity. Queer talk from a bank, Johnny. We're catching flack too from a small mob of his mates, inbred under-manager types here to back him up. Troublemakers, land-despoiling white trash. It'll do them no good. Their turn is coming. They'll be rationalised themselves, made adapt to a multinational society. There's no room in that for privileged traditional ways of life. No land rights for bankers. I'll read you a couple of poems from a new book which doesn't exist yet. It's coming out next year. It's called, or will be called, The Biplane Houses. And that commemorates a fellow called Buchanan who comes around and fixes our house sometimes because we're no good at it. And where are you, Buchanan? Yeah, it's called The Shining Slopes and Plains. Remember, Australian houses are mostly not brick. They're mostly made of lighter materials and have tin roofs. The Shining Slopes and Plains. Having tacked loose tin panels of the car shed together, Peter the carpenter walks straight up the ladder, no hands, and buttons down lapels of the roof. Now his light weight is on the house overhead. Then he's back down, bearing long straps of a wiry green alpine grass, root-woven, fine as fur, that has grown in our metal rain gutters. Bird-seeded or fetched by the wind, it has had 20 years up there, being nourished on cloud dust, on washings of radiant iron, on nesting debris, in which pinch-sized trees had also sprouted. Now it tangles on the ground, and the laundry drips jowls of coloured weight, below one walking stucco, stucco, up and down overlaps to fix the biplane houses of Australia. I was trying to write the sense of smell because one thing I've always been a bit deficient in is the sense of the nose. I think it's more of a woman's gift, actually. Women's one of the strengths of women. But I wrote the whole bunch of poems called the Nostril Songs. I'll read you a few of them, two or three of them. P. Ovidius Naso, when banished from Rome, remained in the city for days on slave clothing, for weeks in his study, for decades in living noses. Mammal self-portraits are everywhere, rubbed on or sprayed on in an instant. Read by nose, they don't give the outline shapes demanded by that wingless bird, the human. With our beacon eyes, we perceive them as smears or turds or nothing at all. Painted from inside, these portraits give the inner truth of their subject, with no reserve or lie. Warned or comforted or stirred, every mammal's an unfoolable connoisseur, with its fluids primed to judge as it moves through an endless exhibition. When I was pregnant, says your sister, my nose suddenly went acute. I smelled which jars and cartons were open rooms away, which neighbours were in estrus, the approach of death in sweat. I smelt termites in house framing all through a town, that mealy taint. It all became as terrible as completely true gossip would be. Then it faded, as if my baby had learned enough and stopped its strange, unhuman education. And finally, this one's true. You can test it. I have, and it works. A teaspoon upside down in your mouth and chopping onions will bring no tears to your cheeks. The spoon need not be silver. It's an old wives' tale, that one. It's true, though. This one was a dust storm, which we had in 2002. Very rare on the coast in Australia. I've only ever seen two of them. And it's called A Levitation of Land. Haze went from smoke blue to beige gradually after midday. The inland was passing over high up and between the trees. The North Hills and the South Hills lost focus and faded away. As the inland was passing over, lungless flies quizzing roadkill got clogged with aerial plaster. Familiar roads ended in vertical paddocks unfenced in obstruction. The sun was back to animating clay. The whole ploughed fertile crescent inside the ranger's longbow offered up billion-ton cargo, compound of hoof prints and debt, stark street vistas, diesel and sweat. This finer skim of drought particles formed a lens, fuzzy with grind, a shield the length of northern Europe, and had the lift of a wing, which traffic of thermals kept amassing over the mountains. Grist, the shade of kitchen blinds, sprinkled every scene. A dust bowl inverted in the sky shared the coast out in bush airfield sizes. A surfer from the 100-acre sea landed on the beach's narrow squeak and remade his hometown out of pastry, a sense of brown snake in the air. And dogs whiffed, scanning their nose paper. Teenagers in the tan foreshortening regained for moments their child voices. And in double image, Vanuatu to New Zealand, an echo Australia gathered out on the ocean, having once more scattered itself from its urn. And oddly enough, better watch the time a bit though, because we've got to do some academic business. I'll read you two or three more. They'll get shorter as we go. Oddly enough, a few weeks before, I'd been thinking of a very similar metaphor about time, comparing time as a weather front. You know, those lines that you see racing over the map? I called the poem The Welter. How deep is the weather front of time that advances, roaring and calm, unendingly between was and will be? A millisecond? A few hours? All secular life worldwide, all consequences of past life, travel in it. It's weird to move ahead of. So I went back to 1938, the year of the sesquicentennial, and it was bare as a drought landscape under a weakened sun. I found few objects, a desiccated brougham in a slab lean-to, a phrenological head defined in segments, all sparse dead matter from far earlier times. Underfoot at first were ghostly streets, but I found my valley by its shapes. No trace of home. My birth and my family were still travelling in the time front and beyond it. Mr. Speed, the last convict who had died that year, may be travelling too in effects of his life. All the human figures I thought I saw out on that country proved to be tall, old-style window tombstones. I became aware that all the clouds there had ever been were up ahead, being recycled in the life front. Beyond flat furrows and exhausted wire, salt frosted the cobble of parched waterholes. But tears underlie every country. Nowhere do they discharge the past, which is the live dark matter that flows undismissibly with us and impends unseen over every point we reach. One day over wing-collared futures towered the dinosaur. This one's a true story, alas. Death from exposure. That winter, we missed her stark face at work. Days till she was found under his veranda. Even student torturers used to go in awe. She had zero small talk. It made no sense she had his key. It made no sense all she could have done. Depression exhausts the mind. She phones, no response. She drives up straight to his place in the mountains, down a side road, frost all day. You knock, what next? You can't manage what next. Back at last, he finds her car. She's crawled in under among the firewood. Quite often the world is not round. I'll finish with a poem about money. It's called The Cool Green. Money just a means to our ends. No, we are terms in its logic. Money is an alien. Millions eat garbage without it. Money too can be starved, but we also die for it then. So who is the servant? Its weakest forms wear retro disguise, subtly hued engraved portraits of kings, achievers, women in the liberty cap, warlords who put new nations on the map. But money is never seen nude. Credit cards, bullion, bare numbers, electronic, in columnar files are only expressions of it, and we are money's genitals. The more invisible the money, the vaster and swifter its action, exchanging us for shopping malls, rewriting us as cities in style. If I were king, how often would I come up tails? Only half the time, really, with all my severed heads? Our waking dreams feature money everywhere, but in our sleeping dreams it is strange and rare. How did money capture life away from poetry, ideology, religion? It didn't want our souls. Thank you.
Could you flip the lights around so we can see you all? This is an audience of readers, an audience to a poet, so often kind of the same thing. I have to say, I've got such a raging cold caught by my 10-week-old son that any questions that I'm going to ask are going to turn out to be a series of nostril songs. So I'm going to actually turn the questions straight over to you and simply chair this, okay? Now, I know that some of you are ready and primed, so let's go. Who's going to be first? Hands up, please, and be economical. Can we have the lights more in the audience, please? Okay, in the corner there. Could you really speak it out loud as well?
Because I'm one of these deaf old kinds. Yeah, I'm fairly autistic myself, so I don't know much about love. I've got to write about what I can. There are forms of love I do pretty reasonably. I know love of landscape and friends and that sort of thing. But I've got a little poem which goes, the truest love poems are known as such to the lovers alone. Yeah? Certain poems are intended for one reading by the person who you love, and by the rest of the world, they don't know there's even love going on there. I've got a set of poems, for example, I think you mentioned them, called Machine Portraits, and with Pendant Spaceman. It's dedicated to my wife, who just happens to like big yellow earth-moving machines. I mean, she must, you know. And so for her, it was a birthday gift. For the rest of the world, it was a set of considerations about large machinery in history. and in present times. So that often is... A lot of poems can be love poetry without showing it. I tend to be suspicious of absolutely overt love poetry, because for two reasons. One, it tends to be either boasting or advertisements. And the other thing is that stream of art has been taken up so thoroughly by pop music that there's not much left for us to say, you know. It's been covered. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What tradition do you come from, by the way? I'm sorry, I'm terribly deaf. What's your lady say?
Algerian,
right.
So generically revolutionary.
Yeah. Well, it probably in a place where the shooting is real, you need love poetry as a counterweight, you know. Yeah. I read you a couple of love poems tonight, I think, and a few more that you didn't know were love poems. There was that one about Marianne Gregg, the girl who committed suicide because she was adopted. But that was one-sided love. I didn't know it was there. I was 15 years old, completely naive, and 16, 17, around there, completely naive, didn't know her needs, and failed her completely. And then she tried my cousin Peter, and he was just as bad. And the poor girl, I hope she found somebody decent before she topped herself, but she may not have done. You know, that love's failures I'm good at. I can write about them. Yeah.
So which kind of poems or poets would you turn to for guidance or exemplariness in a completely unpoetic way, not as models?
Yeah, I've always just read poetry for fun, you know, not necessarily for models. The last, I suppose, big love affair I had with the work of somebody was Elizabeth Peel Bishop. But I read a lot of poetry by all sorts of people, sometimes even without names on it, you know. I tend to think that names are getting less important in poetry, and poetry itself is getting more important, that so many people write it and occasionally bring it off and do it well, often I'm at embarrassed to try and remember whose poem it was I read, you know, and was struck by.
Mm.
And it could have been anybody from Hesiod onwards, you know.
Sure. Is it a problem we can even be bothered about as poets, that fewer than the players of scat actually read it? Fewer than the players of scat actually read the stuff? Probably more than the players of scat actually write the stuff.
I think the Arabs told me that I was being very pessimistic. They said they all love poetry. I was thinking, I guess, largely of the English-speaking world, where it's not followed by a lot of people, except that it is. You know, there's at least 100,000 in Australia trying to write it, we know of. But there's more of them trying to write it than are reading it, you know, I understand, by a great margin.
Yeah.
They'd rather write it than read it. There's a lot of poets will tell you, or a lot of people will tell you, oh, I never read poetry, it would upset my style, it would corrupt my style. Yeah.
Volunteer yourselves.
I've lived in Australia twice, once when I was a very small boy, and recently as part of my gap year. And both times, the only time that nationality has been mentioned to me is when there's rugby or football or cricket on.
Yeah.
And the only time poetry has been mentioned is when I've got drunk and talked about it.
Yeah.
Do the two intersect very much in your mind, and is nationality a more important idea than poetry in the modern world to you?
No, not for me. I come from an odd sort of obsolete part of Australian society anyway, called the bush, you know, called the rural poor, and which has been very much out of fashion in the last 30 or 40 years. And I was told early on that I should be writing urban poetry about disaffection and alienation and that sort of thing. It wasn't the way of it where I came from. You know, the world as seen from there was different. And I didn't kind of want to have my own inheritance switched off as part of a sort of demographical demand. So I became one of the awkward squad of Australian poetry. It just, my timing was off. You know, the orders were out culturally that we were supposed to get urban and urbane and sophisticated. It's what I call gentrifugal force. And every society is plagued by gentrifugal force, you know, the force which drives people to rise in society and despise their parents. And I have written sports poems. I've written 3.5 of them, one about skiing downhill, one about a horse race, that's quite a short one, and one about fencing. All my sports are individual ones, you know. I've never written about gang sports. Main gang sport I know is school bully.
Best training for all the others, I found.
Yeah, I don't like football and stuff much, to tell you the honest, unvarnished. I don't mind tennis. I used to like tennis. I'll read you the little one about horse racing. It'll be instructive. It's an older Australia, but it's still there. Things don't die out just because they're told to. I went to Sydney races. There along the rails, all snap brims and cold eyes, flanked by senior police and other stony men with their eyes in a single crease, stood the entire government of New South Wales, watching Darby ply the whip all for show over this fast colt. It was young and naive. It was heading for the post in a bolt, while the filly carrying his and all the inside money strained to come level. Too quick for the stewards to note him, Darby slipped the colt a low lash to the scrotum. It checked, shocked, stumbled, and the filly flashed by. As he came from weighing in, I caught Darby's eye and he said, "Get out of it, mug," quite conversationally. I'm not the first person to represent the government of New South Wales as a criminal organisation. You know. Paul Muldoon represented the entire American culture as a mafia organisation. Wonderful poem called Imran. I recommend it to you. Yeah, they do go on a bit about sport in Australia, partly because it's not religion. It's something you can talk about. You know, you're allowed to talk about it. It's not love. It's not religion. It's not any of the hot, sort of dangerous topics. It's a neutral topic you can talk about.
It's very easy to take sides over as well.
So it's what?
It's easy to take sides over without being wrong.
Yeah, you're never wrong. No. I mean, is Man United better than Arsenal, or is it not? Who gives a monkey?
You could have rose like them now.
I wouldn't.
Yeah?
You know which is good and which is bad.
It's a very fast ball.
What's that?
It's a very fast ball. I mean, you know, you were asked as a guest to come along. What are you going to do? Choose not to read?
No, I just read poems I think people would like and which I like and which I think work, and I vary it. I try to read a few that I haven't read for a while, and to keep it fresh and keep myself surprised, and. I figure if they can stand up to repeated readings, they probably are all right. The other day I was driving up the road and I thought, what are my 12 best poems? And I got to 9 without any trouble, and then I came to a halt and I thought, maybe I've still got 3 of them to write, you know. But I try this, that and the other one to see how they go. I'm sure that some of them appear extravagantly foreign and weird and incomprehensible over here, but... I've always been curious about that. It's the Wittgenstein question of you may say boo to a goose, but God alone knows what the goose hears. You know, you read to an audience in some northern hemisphere country, and they seem to understand something. You know, you don't know what of your locale, your sort of world is crossing the cultural and geographical boundaries and what or not, but they seem to receive something. I don't know how that happens. I guess I've always done it. You know, we were brought up on Northern Hemisphere literature, and We were told in school books when I was a kid, even as late as when I was a kid, that the sun rose in the the sun was in the south and rose on your left hand and went over and sank on your right hand. And some of us looked out the window, and it turned out not to be so. It was in the north, and it rose on that hand and went down over. That was called the British Empire. You know, they could turn the sun round, those fellas. They really could. It's a question that puzzles me. I don't understand.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, carry on from this question about your literary value of your work. When do you know that a poem of yours is done? When do you feel a yes?
Yeah, it's always a subtle question. When it won't let you back in. When it forbids you to add any more to it. I will take no more interference, thank you, it says. I am done. Other times you let a poem come out and hang around for a long time and you start to worry about something. There's something dragging and catching as you read it. And you realise you didn't get that bit right. And if you unravel that, maybe the whole poem will unravel. And I've had that happen. Sometimes you can fix it. You think, just an obvious step there. It needs fixing and you can fix it. Mostly I think there's what I call there's an aura in which a poem is written, and it might last a week or two. And in that time, you truly can't judge the poem. You feel excited about it, you love it. And after that, it becomes more distant, it becomes more objective, and you can look at it and say, 7 out of 10.
How much stuff do you leave on the cutting room floor?
Not much. Not much. I used to. Yeah, I burned a lot of poetry, like everybody does. Yeah, I should have burned a lot more.
I'm curious about the green book here. Is that something that you create to take to a reading, or is it something that you create in order to give the impression of it being approaching the finished book?
It is done. It's finished. I might stick one or two more in it, but that's the form in which it's gone to the publisher. I just had to get a new publisher in Australia the other day. The one I love very much went broke. Not my fault, not my fault, Your Honour. He was too generous, poor fellow. And I've gone to a new one now, but over here I've got Carcanet, and it'll probably come out from there, I should think. But it's the pinch test, you know, when a manuscript's thick enough, it says probably a book. There's sometimes a touch of structure about it, but that varies. You know, I've had books that are composed, and I've had books that are just like this one, a certain quantum of poems that holds the covers apart to a decent degree.
What was the difference in your working process day by day in composing a book like Freddie Neptune then?
Freddie was funny. It was like a kind of a zeppelin which floated above my life. You know, I could climb up there and go on with Fred. I'd leave Fred for about 6 or 8 months to build up a head of steam, you know, and then I'd go back to it and start writing it again and work on it for about 3 or 4 months, and that'd be a whole book of Fred. And then I'd put it aside and go on writing other poems. It was a different life. It was a sense of, that's a different farm. I can go over and farm that one, or I can stay here and farm this one. And I didn't know where it was going. I had no idea. It was pure automatic writing. It was... I'm not going to interfere with this book. I'm going to set some rules for it, not interfere with it, and see what it tells me. Mm-hmm. And it was an act of divination. Even when it was lumpy and weird, I thought, don't interfere with it. It has its reasons for being lumpy and weird. And I didn't go back and change anything after. One or two things I probably should, just tiny things, but I thought, nah, it'd be bad luck if you went back and changed it. Yeah.
What would you say to the male journalist who told today that poetry was an elitist, obscure, and vastly rubbish?
Poetry was a
elitist, obscure, and vastly rubbish. A male journalist.
He's probably right. in his terms, he was probably right. And that'll keep me from having him as a reader, and we won't annoy each other. I think poetry is escaping from that elitist tag. As it slowly moves away from the universities, it's coming out of there and becoming wider again. I think modernism
trapped it for a while, and it's escaping out into a wider acceptance now. The newspapers are not helping. They're not publishing it. They did up until about the 1940s. And the sporadic, I mean, there's a poem in the Glasgow Herald, yeah, I think every week, and I've seen the odd poem. There used to be one in the Independent, I remember. And put in by that nice black journalist chap who was had a good nose for poetry. And what was his name? MacDonald. And but they haven't been helping us much. And I dare say at least half of the journalists' intention was to rev people up and annoy them and you know, be a bit shocking. But it's a very worn shock, that one. It's been used a lot of times.
It would have been shocking to have said the opposite to you.
Yeah, it would have. That would have been an effective. I would have said in return that poetry is the way that humans really think. And 99.9% of poetry never gets on the page. It's human creativity works that way. It's a mixture of dreaming and thinking and dancing, you know, of gesture and emotion and so on, that out of which people construct the meaningful little nodes of their lives, like their philosophy, their religion, their marriage, perhaps. Four or five, usually people have got about four or five what I call poems in them. They live in those poems and the poems live in them, you know. They don't go down on paper, those poems. I use it, I think Plato was dead wrong. He said that, you know, the highest of all human faculties, the divine in humans, was reason. It's a small part of that process. It's necessary, it's got to be in there, but it's the only part of the process. And so that journalist is living in the poem of journalism. And can't see it. He can't see it because it's facing outwards and he's on the inside of it.
No, you don't have to sit.
I'm sorry?
I said you don't have to sit next to
me.
Yeah.
I suppose the poems that aren't.
Oh, well, yes, we do. Yes, we do.
Yeah.
They come into our lives, you know, the newspapers and the telly and that sort of thing. We see their attitudes. Yeah. Gradually, there's less and less news too. It's more and more of it's just commentary and scandal. And celebrity. Yeah.
One of your poems I really like, but I can't properly pronounce the title of it, the Bula de la
Tari. Oh, the Bula de la Tari holiday song cycle, yeah.
Yeah. The line in that at the beginning, for this is the season when children return with their children. I think it's their rural roots. I wonder whether that still happens in Australia, or have people got so.
Yeah. It happens a heck of a lot, in fact. Yeah, outside of what Mrs. Thatcher calls the chaperoning classes, and even inside them, it happens a heck of a lot. They go to see the relatives up in the country. They are only stepping back a generation or so, and now there's more and more of a movement to go back there themselves. You know, people at the age of 45, they say, "Oh, to hell with it! I'm sick of the rat race," and they go back there, and. Yeah, that was based on an Aboriginal model at Poem. And it won a big prize and everything. It was the Aborigines liked it. They thought it was marvellous. Well, they thought it was a vote of confidence in their culture. Then it later got politicised. People said, oh, Murray's appropriating Aboriginal culture. You can't. Appropriating means thieving, you know. You can't. What they release, they release. And that's in the public domain. What they don't release is their business, and you can't use it because you don't know it. It's not released. It's private to them. I think that we've been terribly coy and pussyfooting about learning from Aborigines, and some of them say so. You know, they say, be more bold, you know, learn from us. You can borrow these things. And just as they have borrowed rhyming couplets and making movies and that, you know. Otherwise, their culture is doomed to be a museum culture. But that was written in 1975, that poem, and I think it still holds up. I think it's all still true. The only thing that's wrong is that the Pacific Highway has been upgraded since, and there are one bunch of hills you no longer have to climb over. There, you just go through. Yeah. Yeah. It was then.
Yeah.
Were there Australian bush poets that you regard as being important to your formation, or did you just start sparking off independent?
Not the bush poets much. We heard bush ballads, and I never took greatly to them. Even when I was a kid, I realised that their meters were set in concrete. They were completely regular. And they were always about the same subjects. They were stuck in the year 1880. And a lot of people in the bush still love those ballads and recite them obsessively. But Australian poetry wasn't taught in school at all back then. It was all pure Shelley and Keats. And I got a lasting dislike of Shelley and Keats out of that. So we all ignored poetry, I think, because we were the boys of the Third World War. We were thought we were going to be soldiers, and then came the 60s, and the world changed, and that became, you know, the fashion moved away from that. Thank God, in many ways, you know. And I was introduced to modern poetry by one teacher just at the end of school. I think it was because he knew he couldn't do anything about school bullying, but he gave me something which was infinitely greater value, which was modern poetry. And another fellow, the sportsmaster, introduced me to modern Australian poetry, and I thought, it's not only Auden and McNeice and Gerald Manley Hopkins, it's also Kenneth Slessor and Douglas Stewart and Judith Wright, you know. And it became relevant. And I started thinking, I can do this, and trying to learn how. Which you do by imitation, you know. Don't let anybody tell you they can teach you, right? Yeah. It's funny how thoroughly the New Zealanders inshallah good stuff there. My favourite is a fellow called Glover, Dennis Glover. But Dennis, is it? I think it's Dennis Glover. Anyway, I've been over and read there a few times, but they're strangely standoffish about us, at sort of official literary level. And they look more to England. Of course, the great changeover in Australia was to America, you know, which I think the New Zealanders have taken rather less strongly. They didn't throw themselves holus bolus at American poetry the way the Australians did. Yeah.
Yeah, John.
Back to Aborigines. In the press here, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but you're portrayed more as a man perhaps to the right than of the left, so more of the Liberals than the Labour Party. I don't know if you'd agree with that, but the Liberal record...
It's a great way of avoiding reading the poems.
True, true. Yeah. Aborigines, the Liberal record was Aborigines. Yeah. Loathsome, isn't it? Especially the
Howard government. I don't know. We'd have to ask them.
The Aborigines or the Liberals?
You know, the Aborigines. A lot of them vote for it. Aborigines are everything from bank managers to tribal people living on tribal land. The first Aboriginal land rights were granted by Liberal parties. I'm not of any party. In the great spectrum of politics, I'm not Manchester Go. I'm not Guardian. I'm not Daily Telegraph. I'm probably about independent. I regard myself as a real independent. I do my own thinking. So if you'll forgive me, fuck politics. I don't care if about left, right, or upside down.
I think that's a very good place to stop. But we're not going to stop upon questions and answers. We're actually going to stop upon poetry. Before we go, before Les reads one further poem, and I've just sneaked the possibility. Every poetry reading I've been to by Les, he always reads the poem Bat's Ultrasound. And
oh, yeah.
You didn't read it today, so just give me a moment to do some advertising. There are books for sale outside here. It's very important you buy them, and not least because you get 10% off if you present your ticket to Writers at Warwick to the bookshop, and then you can bring them down here and have them signed. Christmas is coming. Your mothers and fathers will love getting these books, and you should love your mothers and fathers. The next writer here is Harry Kunsru on Wednesday the 12th of October. Please come to that, and then Salman Rushdie on Monday the 17th of October. Thank you for coming. Thank you to Emma McCormack for organising this, and to the bookshop, and thank you, Mr. Walter Les, but maybe you can thank him after he's read Bat's Ultrasound.
All right. I've always loved bats. I like animals in general, and because growing up with them, I didn't know humans much till I was about 9. And I like both the big, you know, flying fox fruit bats, which run on, navigate by scent, and the little ones who navigate by radar. And I've sometimes suspected they don't know we're here, because they live in a world of darkness and they navigate with this strange high-pitched echolocation system. I wanted to get a sense of that, so you'll find it in the last 6 lines of this poem. Bats ultrasound. Sleeping bagged in a duplex wing with fleas in rock cleft or building, radar bats are darkness in miniature. Their whole face one tufty, crinkled ear, with weak eyes, fine teeth bared to sing. Few are vampires, none fit through the mirror. Where they flutter at evenings, a queer tonal hunting zone above highest sea. Insect prey at the peak of our hearing, drone rare to their detailing tea. Ah, air, aero hour, eh? Or our roar air, our ear, I air your roar row. We air our array, your row rye, or our array. Our eerie, our ray, our arrow. Our rare ear, our eerie, Yahweh.